Imagine this, a weapon that can fly at least 20 times the speed of sound, and it can head anywhere on Earth in less than an hour. This is a hypersonic weapon. China has it, and we don't. This episode is about the history of China's global competition for power, and it's about military might.
Dominant military technology at this time was cavalry. So mounted troops were the most valuable in battle by far. But China then was very good at producing large and fielding large armies composed of infantry. But it was challenged in the cavalry department.
Did it not have enough horses? Was that the issue?
From around the middle of the 7th century until nearly the middle of the 9th century, Tibet was a major power. And it was the Tang China's single most persistent, long-lasting security headache. At one point in the mid-8th century, they briefly occupied the Tang capital of China. But it's often presented as one of the great decisive battles in world history.
Yeah.
Where the Chinese stopped expanding westward, and kind of Islam is then able to move on into Xinjiang, where the Chinese are still confronting it today, although now. In fact, Mao asked Stalin more than once to give him Mongolia back, and the story Stalin just laughed. Traveling in China, I just can't tell you how many times I've been asked, you're an American, so why do you Americans insist on supporting those evil splittists in Taiwan?
Did you know that China's lessons from its long history were quite consequential in China's devastating defeat at the hands of the technologically superior British Navy in the First Opium War in 1839, which ushered in China's century of humiliation? You see, in its long history, serious military threats to China always came from land, from the West or the North, such as the Tibetans, the Turks, the Mongols and the Manchus, and later Imperial Russia. In China's long history, the sea was never a threat, so the Qing Dynasty was not worried about a few European ships showing up at its shores, until they were blindsided from the sea by powerful foreign ships and aggressive foreign powers in the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. China teaches its century of humiliation to its school kids, and every Chinese person knows of this history. And it probably angers them that their long history of superpower status, a history of grand civilization, was interrupted by the West. Given this, what do you think? Will China be blindsided again from the sea? Hey there, news peelers. Today is October 6, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. By the way, as we get into this episode, you have to excuse me because I'm losing my voice. Regardless, I love our weekly program. So here we go. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee, or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. In 2021, Beijing tested a hypersonic weapon that shocked Washington, because it demonstrated how far advanced China's hypersonic weapons program is in comparison to ours. In fact, As I gathered from reading a recent Wall Street Journal report, we don't have much of a hypersonic weapons program, despite pouring billions into research and projects that failed or were canceled or cut back. By the way, Russia has hypersonic weapons too, but their weaponry is not as advanced as China's because it's mostly based on Cold War technologies. China's hypersonic weapons can fly at low altitude, at extremely high speed, and maneuver mid-course. It's almost impossible to intercept them. Even our most advanced ships are defenseless against China's hypersonic weapons. And it's not just hypersonic weapons. The United States is struggling to keep pace with China's military in other areas as well, including artificial intelligence and biotechnology. China's advances in military technologies are game changers in the 21st century global competition of great powers. But China has been here before, sometimes as the victor, sometimes as the vanquished. This is the story of how China's massive state organization and awesome resources empowered China's military to defeat others. It's the story of how internal politics and rebellions limited China's military and geopolitical expansions. It's the story of how China was blindsided by the military power of the West. And it's also the story of how history itself now pressures China's military and government to reclaim what they believe to be their historical borders and territories. No doubt, I'm referring to Taiwan. My guest, Dr. David Graff, is a professor in the Department of History at Kansas State University and the director of the undergraduate program in East Asian Studies. His research focuses on Chinese military history, especially that of the Tang Dynasty. He's currently completing a translation of What Remains of Li Jing's Art of War, a book that many of us are familiar with its name. It's an early Tang military text. He's one of the two editors-in-chief of the Journal of Chinese Military History and has also served as secretary of the Chinese Military History Society since its founding in 1998. Dr. Graff has been the holder of the Richard A. and Greta Bauer Pickett Chair for Exceptional Faculty since 2017. He's the author of several books on China's military history. One book is Medieval Chinese Warfare, 300 to 900, Warfare and History. Another book is The Eurasian Way of War, Military Practice in 7th Century China and Byzantium, Asian States and Empires. And another book yet is A Military History of China. In this episode, Dr. Graff tells us why in China they consider the Tang Dynasty as China's golden age. One of the several reasons, the one that resonates with China's newfound military might and muscle flexing, is that the Tang were assertive militarily and did not bow to foreign pressure. It's easy to see how after a century of humiliation at the hands of foreign powers, China would gaze back at the Tang Dynasty as its golden age. To learn more about Dr. Graff, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. By the way, we discuss many empires and battles in this episode, so to make it easy for you to follow along and get a better perspective, on our website, historybehindnews.com, I provide quick facts, dates, and images, and there will be videos of me and Dr. Graff as well. So stay with me as Dr. Graff and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Graff, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me.
Before we get deep into our conversation here, I want to get a basic clarification, and it's the following. Why is the Tang Dynasty considered by many as China's golden age? It, you know, when I think about it, it wasn't the longest lasting dynasty, and it didn't rule over the largest territory. And I'm not saying those are the only two metrics, but I'm still curious here.
Okay, well, the Tang Dynasty lasted approximately 290 years.
Uh-huh.
So, again, to put that in perspective, you know, the
longer than we've been a country.
Right. The United States hasn't survived that long so far. We haven't gotten that far. So the the Tang also divides into two parts. There's, you could say, the first half before 755 CE and the second half after that. When people think of the Tang as China's golden age, they're really thinking of the first half, when China was militarily powerful, it was expansive, it dominated, not always, but frequently, kind of surrounding steppe areas and to the north and kind of Central Asia to the northwest. That's a time when China was really the dominant power in East Asia, when it had an attractive power over the surrounding countries and peoples. And
what do you mean attractive power? That almost sounds like cultural attractive power.
Yes.
Oh, that's what you mean. Oh, okay. Yeah, I see. Yes.
You'd find people from Central Asia, from as far away as Persia, going to China to do business, to study. Even you'd find Japanese going to China to study, some staying on and even taking positions in the Tang government.
Interesting. I know we can talk about the Tang Dynasty for hours on, but why was it split into
two halves? The Anlushan Rebellion is the short answer to that. That in 755, there was a major military revolt on the northern frontier that threw the empire into chaos for nearly a decade.
I see.
The rebellion failed. But the Tang Dynasty that survived the rebellion was greatly weakened.
Greatly weakened as a result.
Yeah, so the central power was much weaker, and there were many kind of provincial warlords that the court then had to deal with.
But still lasted for some 100+ years still. Let's talk about the subject that I contacted you for, the sort of the thrust of our conversation. I've been very interested in this. China's military history, and let's start with the Tang. What was China's military like at this time?
Okay, well, it's certainly we're really talking about what would be in Western terms a medieval army.
Medieval army. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So this is pre-gunpowder. So there are reports and records of kind of experiments with gunpowder, really among Taoist alchemists, occurring during the Tang Dynasty. But the weaponization of gunpowder doesn't occur until after the fall of the Tang. So it's edged weapons, right? Swords, spears, and projectile weapons, bows. You know, composite bows used from horseback and crossbows used by soldiers on foot. So the Tang is not a time of any major, you know, technological developments or breakthroughs in military technology. So they've inherited a package from earlier times, and we don't see kind of revolutionary new developments, you know, until, you know, after the fall of the Tang in the early 10th century. And it should also add to that a problem that the Tang faced was that the dominant military technology at this time was cavalry. It was So it was so mounted troops were the most valuable in battle by far. But China then was very good at producing large and fielding large armies composed of infantry. But it was challenged in the cavalry department.
Did it not have enough horses? Was that the issue?
That's a problem, yeah, because much of interior China, especially South Central China, is not suitable for raising horses. And the areas that are suitable for raising horses are the grasslands along the northern frontier. So we're talking about what is today kind of inner Mongolia and
interesting.
Ningxia, parts of Gansu and so forth that are steppe, grassland. So one reason that the Tang was so militarily more successful in its first half than in its second was that for most of its first half, it was able to dominate those border grassland areas and kind of raise very substantial numbers of horses on imperial stud farms that then went to provide mounts for the cavalry. So the Tang, could field substantial cavalry forces in its first half. It was much more difficult in the later half of the dynasty.
No, my question, follow-up question, as you were talking about this, the cavalry and stud farms that it had and what have you, did the Tang dynasty have a standing army?
Yes, they did. Yeah. But in fact, they had several standing armies.
Several?
Yeah. So they had a rather complicated military establishment. And that was also, again, because we're talking a period of nearly three centuries, there are changes over time. So early Tang looks very different from late Tang. But in early Tang, they had a standing kind of palace army that varied over time, that was it was originally recruited from the troops who had followed the Tang founder during the establishment of the dynasty, during the fighting beginning in 617. And so you have one sort of force, that palace army that's almost like a Praetorian guard.
Yeah, like Rome, yeah.
And then, but they have a much larger force that is kind of based in the provinces. And it is consists of, I think at its peak, we're talking about 600,000 men. And it's organized into units called fu in Chinese, headquarters, really. I refer to them loosely in English as regiments.
Uh-huh.
They're scattered around the empire, but especially concentrated in regions in northwestern China close to the capital. And these are not full-time soldiers. They have a military commitment that may last for decades. Okay? Men are recruited into this around the age of 20, and they serve until they're close to 60. But it's a sort of a National Guard-like service.
So it's not a – is that still defined as a standing army then?
That is really a matter of definition.
Yeah.
But you always have kind of elements of that army on duty. So they serve by rotation in the capital. So there are always tens of thousands of them on duty in the capital as a sort of a counterweight to the palace army. And then you have some of them being sent to, on a rotational basis, to man fortifications along the northern frontier. We're not talking about the Great Wall. We're talking about discrete forts. The Tang, didn't go in for wall building.
Yeah.
But they went in for fort building. And then you could also call up soldiers on an ad hoc basis for expeditionary armies.
This is conscription, is that it?
Yeah, but again, it's activating a National Guard unit or calling up men from the Tang equivalent of National Guard units.
I see. I'm a bit puzzled by this structure, and I just want to make sure that I get it right. So you have the Palace Guards, which is an army in itself. Then you have a standing army, subject to the definition of that time, in different provinces. This, how centralized is the command structure? Because if it's not, this creates opportunities for rebellion, right?
But the command structure is designed. I mean, it's coup-proofed.
It's
designed to prevent a rebellion. So every one of these regiments in the provinces, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them, is subordinated to one of a limited number of guard commands in the capital. And soldiers are brought in from all of these regiments by rotation. So you don't move a regiment whole with all, say, 1,000 men or 1,200 men from Shanxi to the capital. You don't do that. You take a few men from this regiment, a few men from that regiment, combine them under a guard headquarters in the capital, and, you know, make sure that they only spend about a month in the capital. And then
that's ingenious. They can never conspire.
Yeah. Because,
oh, wow.
And when you create a field army, you can pull together a field army of 100,000 men or more. But again, it's cobbled together from various sources. You take so many men from this regiment over here, so many men from that regiment over there. You rarely take an entire regiment whole. And you find soldiers from other sources too. You have, say, tribal auxiliaries from the steppe.
That are kind of mercenaries?
Yeah, or like not exactly, but they have, the tribal leadership has accepted a subordinate position in relation to the Tang Emperor. And then they have obligations in that regard.
Oh, I see.
And they also call up conscripts, because those regiments that I described are not evenly distributed throughout the empire. They're heavily concentrated in the northwest. So in the east and the south, they access manpower mainly by calling up short-term conscripts, simply for a single campaign.
You know, from my limited knowledge of military history, which comes from a little bit of reading and a lot of movie watching, I want to confess here, Dr. Kraft, this seems so different than what I would envision, to have men of the same region fight for each other. You know, like, the empire is there, but they're literally fighting for each other. They're from the same village, same town. But you tell me that's, it's not like that at all. Many of these men hardly know the person standing next to them.
They probably know the few people who are standing next to them. So at the level of the kind of smallest basic unit, which is a 50 man, the basic tactical unit is 50 men. It's called a Dui. And at that level, you're going to find men who are coming from the same source, the same origin, kind of all from, you know, the same regiment, or all conscripted from the same village. But the farther you get above that, you very quickly run into strangers.
That's interesting. And the genius of this is that these 50 people by themselves are not able to mount any sort of mutiny that really matters.
And the generals don't know the soldiers. The soldiers don't know the generals, because the generals are appointed from the emperor and maintains a stable of generals in the Imperial Guard commands in the capital. And then he'll appoint a general to command an ad hoc army assembled for a particular campaign. And, you know, once the campaign is over, you know, the general goes back to the capital and resumes his billet in the guards.
Yeah.
And the soldiers return to their various regiments or their home villages, depending upon.
That's really interesting. So given this, all of this background, how did China's military under the Tang, and I know it's a vast period, 290 years, compared to the areas surrounding it. I'm a little bit reluctant to use the word nations because Mongols, the Turkic tribes, the Tibetan Empire was there. That was a nation.
Yeah, you could. I mean, one term you could use is polities.
Polities. There you go. That's a great term. Yeah.
Yeah. There were some pretty basic similarities in terms of generally the same range of weapons, you know, the same types of tactics, mixes of varying mixes of kind of cavalry and infantry. Cavalry are typically either kind of armored lancers or more light cavalry armed with composite bows. And infantry are going to be primarily spear armed or sword armed, more likely spear because that's cheaper and easier to fend off cavalry with spears.
Yeah.
Technological differences are small, but you'll find, say, the crossbow used kind of much more extensively as an infantry weapon among the Chinese than anyone else.
So where does the Tong's military superiority, especially in the first half, come from? Is it in its organizational and sheer manpower?
That is a very big part of it. Just the empire's kind of sheer size. Once it's reunited by the Tang founders, it can draw on tremendous resources, and it also, I'd say, has been better organization. There's more of an administrative system, kind of more in the way of what we today call state capacity.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's sheer luck and contingency too comes into play. That when the Tang first came to power, they were not in a militarily superior position relative to the Eastern Turk Empire to the north. And the Turks would launch kind of repeated raids all the way to the outskirts of the Tang capital.
Wow.
And what did the Turks in? It was really, but to put it bluntly, it was in part their own fissiparous political structure that kind of led to kind of disagreements among various members of the ruling family, who all had their own followings and their own appanages and so forth. And the Tang were able to exploit these disagreements among the Turk leadership. But also the Turks were hit by terrible weather that froze the pastures, that caused die-offs of their herds and encouraged the rebellion of subject tribes. So when the Tang finally struck against the Turks in 629 and 630, the Turks were already badly weakened.
Interesting. So organization really comes in sort of the state organization is a big part of this superiority. How did the Tang compare to the Tibetan Empire? I know many of us look at Tibet in modern age as this peaceful nation, but at one point in their history, they were really an empire, and they fought real wars and they won.
Yeah, and they at one point in the mid 8th century, they briefly occupied the Tang capital of China.
We're
only talking a space of a couple of weeks. But they briefly occupied the Tang capital, Tibet. So from around the middle of the 7th century until nearly the middle of the 9th century, Tibet was a major power, and it was the Tang China's single most persistent, long-lasting security headache.
Oh, wow.
You have this strong, well-organized empire to the west that they attack you. They're moving downhill through passes they control.
Yeah.
There's almost no way for you to get at them in their heartland.
Oh, that is fascinating. Yeah, yeah. You have to literally climb uphill to get to them. These are, mountain passes that they know and they command.
So really the core areas of the Tibetan state were really off limits to Tang armies. But it was really a one-way street, not a two-way street.
Oh, that's fascinating. You talked about Tibet as the empire to the west as being a headache. I can think of two other empires to the west. One was the Sasanian Persian Empire, which lasted some 600 years. Its tail end sort of overlapped with Tang, and the other Byzantium, the East Roman Empire. How did the Tang military power and prowess compare to theirs?
Yeah, and I've done a bit of work comparing Tang with Byzantium.
Okay. Oh, wonderful.
Much less detailed comparison with the Sasanian Empire. Mm-hmm. But again, it's similar ranges of technology. I think what sets the Tang apart is the crossbow and more extensive use of that than anyone else. But there are the huge areas of similarity, especially between the Tang and the Byzantines, is that they are using very similar tactics. So if you compare, say, a Tang military manual and a Byzantine military manual of approximately the same era, within about a century or so, the recommendations are very similar. And it's actually easy to lose track of whether you saw something in the Byzantine or the Chinese source, because they're so similar. They're making kind of the same recommendations, and they're thinking in terms of the same sort of warfare, warfare that in which cavalry is usually decisive, and where you're very often going to be fighting against an enemy who's superior in cavalry or entirely cavalry, against, say, nomadic opponents, and how to avoid being outwitted, trapped, ambushed, or tricked by your steppe adversary.
That is fascinating. And just correct me if I'm wrong, the Byzantium Empire and the Tang Dynasty, Tang Empire, they don't have borders together. The Persian Sasanian Empire is this giant block in the middle.
Right. And the Tang borders kind of at one point kind of reach just about all the way to Persia.
Yeah.
But not enough that there was ever a serious confrontation.
Interesting. Speaking of Persia, empires of Islam expands and the Sasanian Persian Empire ends. The royal family of the Sasanian Empire flees and they go and they become refugees under the Tang Dynasty. They're very sort of romanticized stories by Persians about how they look to the west to come back home. And the Tang actually did fund some of their forays into their homeland, Persia. There's one battle that really stands out, and it's a little bit after that period. It's the Battle of, help me with the pronunciation, Talas?
Yeah, that's just how I would say it, yeah.
This battle, not just in terms of Persia or anything like that, could have really changed history. China is pushing west against this new empire, new civilization, and then they don't win this battle. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So we're talking about the year 751. Mm-hmm. And the Tang are coming up against the forces of, if I remember correct, I'm much less good on Arab history, but I think it's still the Umayyad.
Okay.
At this point, the Abbasid revolution hasn't quite occurred yet. And this is fought in Central Asia, so we're really in what would now be probably Kyrgyzstan.
Okay. So northwest prior territories of the Persian Empire. Northeast, I'm sorry, I misspoke. Northeast, yes.
Right. And really both the Chinese and the Arabs are competing for kind of domination over the local Turkic population.
Okay.
What really proves kind of decisive in the battle is that, you know, Turkic, you know, contingents there, you know, choose to go with the Arabs rather than the Chinese forces, which is kind of critical in bringing about the Chinese defeat. But it's often kind of presented as one of the great decisive battles in world history.
Yeah.
Where the Chinese stopped expanding westward, and kind of Islam is then able to move on into Xinjiang, where the Chinese are still confronting it today.
Exactly, they're
camps and barbed wire. There are problems with that, and that the Chinese forces were essentially trying to hold a position that they had already been established. So they were not, in a sense, involved in really aggressive expansion at that point in that area. And
interesting.
And the Chinese didn't really push back again after that because of the rebellion I mentioned before, the Anlushan Rebellion. So after 755, again, we're talking just 4 years from 751 to 755. Yeah. And after 755, the Han court has much more important things, much higher priorities to do than fighting the Arabs 1,000 miles to the west or more.
Interesting. Now, so
they have to hold on to their own core territories and suppress a rebellion that at its height occupied both of the empire's capitals, Chang'an, the main capital, and Luoyang, the eastern capital.
You know, this is an interesting perspective. So even though we look at that with the, 1400 almost years of history behind us and saying this was a pivotal moment, it may be that to the Chinese then, I mean, they like to win every battle, yes, sure, but it was not that humongous of a deal because they were just holding their positions and they got bigger fish to fry. Am I correct?
Yeah. No, they had much higher priorities
in terms interesting. Of what
they had to deal with. So you could argue that was true on the Arab side too, that you have then the Abbasid revolution coming along and
Now the Umayyad that won this battle, they actually had other things to deal with.
Yeah. So it's really in terms of world history, the Battle of Talas is this it's almost this bizarre kind of one-off where these two empires at their absolute limits come into conflict with each other, fight one battle, and then both are kind of pulled away because they have other priorities elsewhere.
You know, maybe that's the reason why they make such a big deal off of this battle, because it's a one-off. It's not, it really is a battle. It's not really a war that continues. And that's why.
There's no sequel.
There you go. There's no sequel. And that's why many people in history think it was so pivotal.
We find the territory in between too, from after the outbreak of the Anlushan Rebellion, being dominated by the Tibetans. So that the stretches of Silk Road there in what's now Xinjiang, kind of in between the Arabs and the Tang, are controlled by the Tibetans.
Interesting. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the military might of the Ming Dynasty, the famous Chinese Wall, and even the more famous, the treasure ships.
Here are four major technological innovations before the Industrial Revolution, innovations that changed history. Movable type printing press, paper, compass, and gunpowder. They were all invented in China, yet their economic values were realized in Europe and not in China. Recently, I had a conversation with Dr. Huang of MIT's Sloan School of Management about how China's highly advanced technology and its gigantic economy fell behind Europe's. He is the author of the recently published book, The Rise and Fall of the East, and the word East in this title is in all caps. It stands for exams, autocracy, stability, and technology. Dr. Huang tells the story of how these four elements brought China's success and why they might lead to its decline. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Dr. Huang, which was in season 3, episode 37. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Graf. Dr. Graf, is there anything that stands out about the Ming Dynasty's military power and prowess?
Okay. I am much less of an expert on the Ming than the Tang. So,
okay.
Certainly the Ming Dynasty, for the most part, was going to much less expansive than some earlier dynasties like the Han and the Tang. So the Ming never really expanded to dominate territory in Central Asia, and it was not really able to establish any kind of lasting sort of hegemony over the steppe territories to the north. Mm-hmm. So it kind of differed from Han and Tang there. So for the most part, more defensively inclined than...
I think that's going to answer one of my questions. They rebuilt, they sort of retrofitted, if you will, upgraded the Chinese wall that was there for some time. Was that an overreaction, an emotional overreaction to Mongols' prior centuries' conquest of China?
I wouldn't argue that it wasn't, or that wasn't an element there.
I see.
But again, I think wall building was more mid and late Ming than early Ming. So we were talking kind of more, certain periods in the kind of mid 1400s and into the 1500s. The sections of wall that tourists see around Beijing, mm-hmm. That are Badaling and all that that's 16th century work, and before it was repaired by the current government, it was
interesting. Is there a significance to the fact that the wall building came in the mid and late Ming period?
Certainly, because they were certainly more. The Ming was at its most confident and expansive in its early period, and felt least threatened. So that was when the Ming was launching, say in the late 1300s, cavalry offensives into the Mongolian steppes, to keep the Mongols off balance.
Were the Mongols still a threat to the Ming?
Again, the Mongols were definitely on their rear foot in the late 1300s, early 1400s, after having been expelled from China. But they recovered in the 1400s and the 1500s. And one measure of the extent of the recovery is the Tu Mu incident that occurred in 1449. Where the then Ming emperor was persuaded to lead a large army that is, some sources claim it was as large as 500,000 men. I am personally very dubious about that, but I'm not a Ming expert, to lead this huge army out onto the steppe, to edge of the steppe at least, to confront the Mongols. And this army was defeated, wiped out. The emperor was captured. The Mongols kind of briefly laid siege to Beijing.
Oh my goodness! They didn't
capture the capital, but this was, and they had to shuffle a different member of the imperial family, the Zhu family, onto the throne because the emperor had been captured.
So, oh my God! Based on this, the Mongols were quite powerful.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so this goes a long way to explain kind of why the voyaging of the early Ming stopped.
Oh, you're talking about the treasure ships.
Yes. Yeah. So that they had much more urgent problems, much closer to home. And sending out treasure fleets began to appear a luxury that the empire could not afford.
Oh, interesting. Here they are, this, you know, expending all these resources on these gigantic treasure ships. Now, I've read a lot about the treasure ships, some of them exaggerated, others probably more factually based, if you will. From what I gather is that Europe at the time didn't have any naval power that could compare to these treasure ships. How true is that?
Basically, it's true.
Oh,
that's in the we're talking about the early 1400s.
Yeah,
and this is the time when the Portuguese, Henry the Navigator, just kind of slowly starting to feel their way, kind of mile by mile along down the coast of West Africa.
Yeah. Right, and it's almost like Morocco, 90 years.
Mauritania down to Senegal.
Exactly. And it's decades, yeah. AD, 90 years before Columbus.
Right. And they're sending few ships and small. And certainly naval warfare was not unknown in Europe, say, with the experience of France and England during the Hundred Years' War, with all the galley fighting in the Mediterranean, no European state could build a fleet of that size, nor could any of the European states send a fleet of that size or any size in the early 1400s so far away. So the Ming really had the field to themselves at that point.
What happened to those ships? Were they just abandoned, burned? Yeah, or?
They were basically mothballed and allowed to rot away eventually.
Wow, interesting. Just two follow-up questions on the Ming. One is, did they have a permanent class of soldiers?
Yes, they did, but it was an
by class, is that like societal class? Is that it?
Yeah, it was, but that they had military households at the beginning of the Ming dynasty. Certain families were designated as military households, and members of those families had a military obligation, and members of other families, you're either Bing or Min, and if you were Bing, you had a military obligation, your household. And if you were Min, who are the vast majority of the population, you didn't. And then
these were surnames, or they're just categories?
They're classifications.
I see.
You're military or your civilian household.
What, so being in the Bing
It's a group. Bing, B-I-N-G, and then the alternative is Min, M-I-N.
Was that a coveted classification to have?
No.
No.
again, not being a Ming expert, I can't go into all the details, but as it developed over time, the military status was rather burdensome. That, say, military commanders would put their kind of hereditary subordinates to work kind of as if they were household servants or serfs.
Oh,
and
boy.
Put them to work on their estates and so forth.
Oh, boy. Just last question about Ming before we move on. Did they use gunpowder by then?
Yes, they did. So the Ming, by the Ming, it's like, fully, gunpowder is fully weaponized. And you have kind of real cannon being used from the very beginning of the Ming dynasty.
And that didn't stop the threat of the Mongols?
No. Going to mention an argument made by a good friend of mine, Ken Chase, who wrote a book about gunpowder in world history. But the gunpowder weaponry is especially early gunpowder weaponry, is not all that useful for fighting against nomads.
Interesting. Okay, yeah.
Cannon are heavy, hard to drag around. They slow you down. Handheld firearms have very little range and or accuracy. They have less range or accuracy than a composite bow.
Oh, I see. Especially against the cavalry that is moving right. So fast.
So you're a bunch of musketeers with primitive handguns marching on foot. Meanwhile, the nomads, who have a much better weapon system than you, still are running circles around you. And where the gunpowder weapons are useful is defending static positions, like fortresses, like segments of the Great Wall, like that. And this may help to explain why, you know, the Mongols could encircle Beijing from time to time, but they couldn't take it.
They could also probably be helpful for siege, as siege weapons for, you know, bombarding a wall.
Right.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about the Qing Dynasty, the arrival of the West, and the Opium Wars. We'll be right back. Hey there, News Peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on U.S. politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries, like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy. And also a series on revolutions and protests, like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. Dr. Graf, is there anything that stands out about Qing's military power and prowess? The last empire of China, right?
Yeah, and certainly arguably the most successful, because it was the of all of China's imperial dynasties, because it was the Qing that finally solved the problem of the nomads.
Ah,
and it was because the Qing came from outside.
They were Manchurians.
They came in, yes, with an army that was in part a steppe army of mounted archers. But to that, they melded other elements, including artillery. So they had, you know, up-to-date artillery, much of it kind of served by Han Chinese artillerymen that they brought into their system. And they had plus a steppe cavalry force. So they were very good at drawing upon the various talents and capabilities of various peoples in East Asia that they brought under their control to further extend their dominance.
Did they solve their Tibetan headache?
They did, yeah. And in fact, the Tibetan headache had largely dissolved much earlier due to changes in Tibet. So that the Tibetan state that had been such a threat to the Tang really deteriorated and fell apart in the mid 9th century.
I see.
And kind of thereafter, what followed in Tibet was not so imperialistic or militarily aggressive. And of course, Tibet was conquered by the Mongols, dominated by the Mongols in their heyday, in the heyday of the Yuan dynasty in China. And then really during the Ming period, kind of nothing arose in Tibet to threaten China seriously.
Oh, so the Qing really didn't need to deal with them.
But then the Qing moved on in and did establish their dominance over Tibet. So Tibet was, in fact, incorporated into the Qing Empire, and a Qing resident was installed in Lhasa in the early 18th century, I'm sorry, to keep early 1700s, to keep an eye on the Dalai Lama.
So the Qing dynasty conquers Tibet and many other regions. Its borders resemble very much modern China's borders. It's the largest border territory in China's several thousand year history, right?
Actually larger. The Qing.
Larger.
The Qing at its height exceeded today's People's Republic of China, mainly because of Mongolia. What is now the independent nation of Mongolia was part of the Qing Empire.
When did China lose Mongolia?
Mongolia was basically after the 1911 revolution in China, mainly due to Tsarist Russian interference.
I see. And it became sort of a buffer between the two countries.
Right. But it was basically Russian power and influence, you know, that kept kept China from reabsorbing Mongolia. And in fact, Mao asked, you know, Stalin more than once to give him Mongolia back. And the story is Stalin just laughed.
As I'm laughing now, it's like, yeah, I'll give you back. With respect to the Qing, I want to ask you about a specific period. Let's go to the First Opium War. This really amazes me. We all know the story. The British India Company forces China to buy opium from India. I'm really condensing it here, simplifying it. And the British government finally gets involved, because British goods, i.e. opium, are being confiscated by the Chinese government. Anyway, what's fascinating is how, and I hope my words aren't offensive, but I can't think of another word, how clueless the Qing military elite were regarding British military capability. Is that an accurate or somewhat accurate description?
Yeah, it is, but it's not because China's ruling elites were stupid.
I didn't say it's stupid. I just used the word clueless. They were really shocked that, this is a victory.
But how much Britain's superiority was the product of the Industrial Revolution, which was a very recent development. So, and this is perhaps one place where, you know, China's famous long-term thinking did them a disservice, because they were thinking in terms of what they had been used to, not just for the centuries that the Qing had been in power, but also for millennia, that the sea had never been a threat.
Oh.
The threat always came from the inland frontiers.
That's true.
And that the Qing were still, by and large, oriented in that direction. They were kind of much, much more concerned about their dealings with Tsarist Russia rather than the British.
And to the extent that the sea was a threat, it was more like Japanese pirates that were a nuisance. Yeah, they were not like a naval power.
Japanese pirates were even largely a thing of the past, but by the time that the Qing dynasty was being established.
That's true.
Certainly by 1700, the Japanese pirates were no longer an issue, and the Tokugawa shogunate had things sewed up pretty tightly in Japan. To the extent that Westerners had been poking around the coasts of China, the Portuguese showed up, engaged in a little bit of piracy, and then were bought off very easily by being given a toehold in Macau.
Yeah.
Where they existed on sufferance, because the Chinese found that arrangement convenient, right? They worked that out with the Ming dynasty, and the Qing dynasty continued it. And then you had the Dutch East India Company, right, moving into Taiwan. And then they got expelled from Taiwan by Chinese pirates.
Oh, so, wow. Chung Chun
Pong, as pirate fleet, expels the Dutch in roughly 1660s. And then the Qing dynasty, then in the early 1680s, you know, conquers Taiwan, incorporates it into the Qing Empire, but with a little bit of assistance from the Dutch. So... So they're not exactly worried about Westerners. You know, Westerners show up in with few ships, smallish ships, wanting to trade. You know, and they're people who had not proved to be a major military threat before, and the coast is not where the threats come from, historically speaking.
That's really interesting.
So you could say that they were clueless, but it was because they were blindsided by a sort of threat they had never had to confront before in their entire history.
And where British ships just leaps and bounds advance as far as technology is concerned, or
some were, but if you're thinking about, say, even a European wooden sailing ship, say a frigate or ship of the line of the early 19th century, was certainly far superior in its capabilities, both kind of firepower and kind of maneuverability, to Qing warships at that time. But what was really leaps and bounds ahead were vessels such as the HMS Nemesis, which was a steam propelled vessel, you know, very, very low draft, or shallow draft, excuse me, that could kind of operate, was very maneuverable, could easily operate in China's coastal waters and up its river estuaries, and also packed a lot of firepower.
And Chinese couldn't compete with that.
You know, fire, explosive shells, and so forth. So there's one famous print of an engagement during the Opium War. You see it in a lot of textbooks, on the cover of some books these days, that shows, you know, Chinese warships just exploding after just going sky high after being hit by a shell from the Nemesis.
Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Graf as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Graf, We went through the Tang, the Ming, and the Qing dynasty and got some overviews. What I'm wondering is that, what's the legacy of China's long imperial military history to modern China now?
It's just the question is just where to start. You know, there are so many legacies. You know, certainly there is some of the kind of desire to emulate kind of the glory of Imperial China at its peak periods.
So what do they look back? What do they point to when they talk about peak period?
Where we started, you know, the golden age in the first half of the Tang Dynasty.
They go back to the Tang.
When Chinese today think of the Tang Dynasty, unless they're academic specialists, what they tend to think of most reflexively is the first half of the dynasty before the rebellion, when, you know, China is kind of glorious, powerful, and dominant in its region.
So what does that tell them? That tells them to be more
more assertive, certainly, and not wanting to bow to foreign dictation of any sort.
Is that a recent development in the last decade or so, or is this sort of an undercurrent that hadn't surfaced until recently?
You know, this certainly has been present for a long time, and you can find it too in Mao's China, but Mao's dealings with the outside world, certainly for a while, Chairman Mao felt that he had to play second fiddle to Stalin. And certainly today, China finally, you could say, has the wherewithal to throw its weight around.
Of course.
In a way that it could not in the 1970s, let alone the 1980s or the 1990s.
Going back to Chairman Mao, I think China went to the brink of war with the Soviet Union, or perhaps they even fought a war. They had the skirmishes.
Shots were fired and there were casualties.
Okay.
Especially at Junbao Island, yeah.
I know that President Xi and prior premiers have referred to this phrase, 100 year, the 100 year humiliation, 100 years of shame.
Century of humiliation.
There you go. Does this play in China's military muscle flexing now?
So yes, it does. Yeah, all of these, the answers here have to be complicated and nuanced and longer than you'd like. But
and this century of humiliation starts from the first Opium War that we discussed in the last segment. Yeah,
conventionally counted from the first Opium War to the establishment of the People's Republic of China. Chairman Mao declares that the PRC has been established, right, and China has stood up.
Does this inform us at all about, I know we're talking history, but now I'm intrigued because you're talking about the first half of the Tang Dynasty, where they were offensive, assertive, and that's what modern Chinese elite point to as the Golden Age. What does that inform us about Taiwan then?
This helps to explain why they want Taiwan back so badly.
Yeah,
that every Chinese dynasty or, so I'd say, major regime formation, since you can't quite call the People's Republic a dynasty, has really tried to recover the territories that its predecessor held. So the Tang were very keen to get a hold of the territories that the Han Dynasty had held, and they were interested in their early decades in getting a hold of Korea. Because that had been part of the Korean Peninsula, had been part of the Han Empire at its height.
Oh.
If the Tang failed in that regard, and eventually subsequent Chinese dynasties gave up on Korea. But say the Song Dynasty always had a sort of a psychological problem, because they didn't control the territories in the Song Dynasty that their Tang predecessors had, especially the 16 prefectures around today's Beijing were lost to the Khitan or Qidan.
That probably became national shame and
absolutely. That was a lot of Northern Song politics. And again, I'm not a Song expert. My friends like Peter Lord, who do Song history, could speak in depth to this point. But so much of Northern Song politics kind of revolved around, the humiliation of the loss of the 16 prefectures, and what policies should be pursued to recover the 16 prefectures.
And here, the CCP's, China's Communist Party's predecessor, is the Qing Dynasty, which held Taiwan, until they lost it to the Japanese.
Yes.
So, ergo, they want to go get Taiwan. Oh, that's fascinating. And also dangerous.
It's a legitimacy issue, ultimately.
For the ruling party?
Yeah, for whoever is the ruler, making the Chinese state whole again.
When you say it's a legitimacy issue, is this something that ordinary people in China talk about, think about, or is this something the upper echelons are calculating?
And this is something that the ordinary people care about too, and in part because they have been taught what to think in the process of their education, school, and through state-controlled and state-dominated media. But
I see.
Traveling in China, I just can't tell you how many times I've been asked, you're an American, so why do you Americans insist on supporting those evil splittists in Taiwan?
Just like an ordinary person.
Yes, quite ordinary people, male, female, not just taxi drivers.
Wow, this is fascinating. And this is taught in their schools, which they have, I'm sure they have a national curriculum. It's not like us where every county and state has a different curriculum, and become sort of their national belief, national theme, right?
Yeah.
I want to go, as we're talking about culture, I want to talk about a movie that I saw on PBS, review of a movie. It's called Born to Fly. It's China's latest movie, and it's kind of like our Top Gun. And this has a historic precedent for me anyway. I've read this about the Ming Dynasty. One of the issues that the Ming Dynasty had, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in its especially later period, is that many families wanted to be in business. They wanted to be merchants. And it was really a burden to go and serve in the military. You actually alluded to that in two segments ago. One of the things that this movie does, people should really Google it and see its review. It's about Chinese nationalism. But one of the things that it does, it also is promoting patriotism and service to the country above being in a business and all the luxury that comes along with it. I think there's a scene where a young pilot, you know, his parents tell him to go work for this company or a startup, and he says no, he wants to serve the country. Is that what's happening now? Is that what they're pushing?
Well, yes, certainly I would say that this is an issue in the PRC and really has been since really Deng's reforms kicked off around 1980. And they especially produced results in the agricultural sector first. And, you know, under Mao, the soldiers were gotten for the People's Liberation Army nominally by conscription. But in fact, males in the countryside wanted to serve in the military. Anybody who was at all able-bodied. So their allegedly conscription system, meant basically turning away, finding excuses to turn away young men who wanted to serve. Because under the Maoist system, if you were in a farm family, in a people's commune, almost your only ticket to get away from the farm, out of your commune, out of your production brigade was military service.
Oh, interesting.
So that was the golden, or I should say the red road, the bright red road to social mobility for peasants. And in part because their life was so hard and there were so few options. And Deng's reforms made it possible for farm families to get rich or to at least do considerably better than they had before. And then that led to a problem of it, with finding the recruits they needed for the men really willing to serve in the PLO. So this is not a new problem. It's just it's a more recent version of it. It's kind of the 2023 version as opposed to the 1983 version. And now it's what they want for the military, what they need for the military are young people with a high level of skills, high tech, modern skills, highly educated is what, and of course there's competition for that sort of talent.
Exactly. And highly educated that is willing not to go make a gobs of money in a startup and go serve in the military instead, right?
They could have a high tech job, they could be a fund manager, whatever. And so you've got so many other options. You know, why pilot a jet fighter?
Wow. You
know, or why be a computer expert for the PLA?
Exactly.
You could make so much more in the private sector, right? So, but I would say I'm hesitant to extend this logic back to the Ming Dynasty or earlier.
Okay.
Or even the Qing Dynasty, because I think that this is a problem of a modern economy, not a pre-modern economy. And if you think back to Imperial China, the vast majority of the people are farmers. They're in farm families. You know, so if you're born into a poor peasant family, it's not like you're weighing, should I consider a career in the military versus a career in business? Career in business for 99% of them is a pipe dream.
Yeah.
And the military, though, is a plausible alternative if and when it's recruiting to life on the farm. So, say during the warlord period, the 1920s and 1930s, warlords never had a problem finding soldiers for their armies. And like my friend Diana Laurie's written a whole book about this, about warlord soldiers in that period. And in the late Ming, they actually did find mercenaries willing to fight in their armies. And if you can consider for the young man on the farm, farm life means backbreaking labor under the hot sun, maybe not every day, but for significant parts of the year. And then for most farm families are poor and living close to the subsistence level once they've paid their rents and their taxes and all that. So the military is an inviting alternative because, again, you're getting paid.
It's one less mouth to feed.
Over your head. It's three hots and a cot.
Yeah.
And yes, you're likely to be asked to do fighting now and then. You might be killed, but you're usually not in combat every day. Most soldiers spend most of their time in garrison.
Wow, that's fascinating.
So it's not a bad alternative.
Yeah. So I see the distinction between that period and this is a modern period issue, but nevertheless, still the issue. And sometimes it resonates when you're reading along China's long history. Dr. Graf, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so much, Dr. Graf.
Okay, you're welcome.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News. a history podcast, for our news.